Welcome to the Legal Nurse Podcast, where you'll get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside the legal nurse consulting business. They'll share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with over 30 years' experience. So join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's your host, Pat Iyer.
Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast. This is Pat Iyer, and I have with me today Carolyn Bupert, who is an attorney who focuses on legal issues affecting nurses and advanced practice clinicians and their employers. Her clients include hospitals, health systems, insurers, physician and nurse practitioner practices, visiting nurse agencies, nursing homes, hospices, schools of nursing, and a national certification organization. She practiced as a nurse practitioner for 16 years before focusing exclusively on legal matters. Carolyn is also an author, and you may have encountered some of her books and columns. She has written, just in the last 3 years, several books and instructional CDs. They include The Nurse Practitioner's Business Practice and Legal Guide, a 2017 publication, Frequently Asked Legal Questions That Keep Nurses Awake at Night, Billing Physician Services Provided by Nurse Practitioners, Negotiating Terms of Employment, and Avoiding Malpractice, and this is all in the last 3 years. She is a frequent contributor to the Journal of Nurse Practitioners and Medscape.com, and lectures extensively on legal issues regarding the scope of practice, compliance, prescribing, malpractice, privacy, and reimbursement issues. And she lives in Boulder, Colorado, which in my experience has some of the finest restaurants in the state of Colorado. Welcome to the show, Carolyn.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
I see that you started as a nurse, then became a nurse practitioner, and then went into law as an attorney. Tell us about the transition from going from being a nurse to becoming an attorney. What caused you to make that move in your life?
Yeah, well, I actually started out straight out of college as a writer and editor, and for most of the 10 years after college, worked as a writer-editor for medical institutions. And then I decided I wanted to be a healthcare provider and went to nursing school. And in my 20s, I was interested in the law, but I really wasn't interested in working all day and then going to school all night, which was what was going to be necessary. So after I became a nurse and then went to graduate school to become a nurse practitioner, I got so used to working and going to school all the time that it no longer seemed onerous to go to work all day as a nurse practitioner and go to law school at night. And that's what I did pretty quickly after getting out of graduate school as a nurse practitioner. I got a job, a day job at Johns Hopkins, and then would run over to the law school at 5:30 and be there till 9:30. And that was a grind, but it somehow, as I got older, it didn't seem like as much of a grind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm very glad that I now combine all three things, writing and nursing and law. It's worked out quite well.
And there's such an emphasis in the legal world on how well you write and can express yourself. So those three pieces intertwine very nicely.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I know that you focused a great deal in your practice on some of the legal risks that are affecting nurse practitioners and other advanced practice people. Let's talk about some of the specific issues that they face as it comes to liability.
Well, just like with any other kind of healthcare provider, especially physicians, nurse practitioners always have the threat of malpractice hanging over their heads. So my role is I don't do litigation, but I have in the past, but I don't do litigation regarding malpractice. But I try to inform nurse practitioners through talks I give and writings about what they need to know to avoid malpractice. So I have been, for the last 20 years, collecting cases against nurse practitioners, as much as I can find out about those cases, and then analyzing them, trying to figure out what went wrong, and then translating all that into either articles or talks about how nurse practitioners can avoid malpractice, and sort of like, here's what went wrong in this situation and what we can learn from that to avoid that happening in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the common threads that you see in terms of why nurse practitioners are named as defendants?
Well, any studies that have been done on this say that the most common reasons nurse practitioners are sued is for missing a diagnosis or not diagnosing in a timely manner, and lack of follow-up. And often lack of follow-up leads to the delay in the diagnosis. So those are the two common things, and those are the same reasons that primary care physicians are sued, I'm told.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any difference in terms of the frequency with which nurse practitioners are named as defendants in the last decade or so?
Yeah, well, I'm only going on survey data from sources such as NSO, which insures nurse practitioners, and they have white papers on nurse practitioners in malpractice. And if you look at their graphs, the line is going up over the years of suits against nurse practitioners, but it's not a dramatic rise, and it's consistent with the increase in numbers of nurse practitioners that have happened over the years. So I don't know that the percentage is growing, or if it is, it's growing alarmingly. Nurse practitioners are still sued infrequently, less frequently than physicians by far. And one way to sort of judge how bad it is, or how good it is what's the premium for insurance. And it's still relatively inexpensive for nurse practitioners to buy their own malpractice insurance policies. So I don't see it as it's a problem. No one wants to be the one sued, but I don't see it as a burgeoning threat. It's just a gradual rise and consistent with a rise in the numbers.
Do you have any theories about why nurse practitioners would be sued with less frequency than physicians?
Well, for one thing, there's the public perception that the nurse practitioners aren't really doing much on their own. I mean, that's changing, but the public perception in the past has been the physician is running the show. That's who we should sue. Second of all, nurse practitioners aren't viewed as deep pockets. Physicians probably are. I mean, I'll leave it at that. Those are the main two, I think, that I would come to mind. Yeah.
Another factor that might influence this is something that I learned when I was doing a presentation in Japan at the International Council of Nurses, and there was a great deal of research that was shared about patient satisfaction and outcomes with nurse practitioners compared to primary physicians. And what I took away from that was that across the board, on all parameters, patients tended to be more satisfied with the care that they got and the communication and the patient teaching from a nurse practitioner when compared against a primary care physician.
Yeah, Pat. That is another reason I've often heard. I don't have any data to prove it, but I've often heard that because nurse practitioners supposedly spend more time than physicians, they are sued less often. So I've heard that. I don't have any personal data to support it, but it could very well be true.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know in reading those verdicts that you've been tracking for 20 years, you've seen trends and patterns. Are there any red flags that come up from looking at those cases that are the things that you've seen more frequently or the hot spots that our listeners should be aware of?
Yeah. Breast complaints. There are quite a number of cases over the years of missed breast cancer. Either there is a lump, but maybe an ultrasound is done, but a biopsy isn't done. It turns out to be cancer. Or there's this one case that stuck in my mind where a young lady in her early 30s came in to a nurse practitioner complaining of a breast rash. The nurse practitioner evaluated it and thought it was a mastitis that could be treated with antibiotics, topical antibiotics, so said, you know, put this ointment on, and if it doesn't go away in 2 weeks, see a dermatologist. The patient did not see a dermatologist. The patient came back, say, 6 months later, complaining about something else, and neither the nurse practitioner nor the patient brought up breast rash. The patient came back again another 3 months about yet another complaint, and again, the breast rash was not brought up by either party. And then about 3 months after that, the patient comes back again, lumpy breasts, and it turns out that the breast rash was in fact Paget disease, and it had been untreated. The patient had been died 18 months after that of this problem, and the family sued the nurse practitioner. So that's an example of a breast case. That one is complicated because the patient came back several times and yet no one brought up the breast rash. Well, should the patient have brought it up? Well, yeah, but should the nurse practitioner have revisited that problem? Yeah. Was it not on the problem list? And so the take home that I give for that case is you got to have a good problem list or somehow make sure that you address a previous problem and was it resolved, and if it wasn't resolved, do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one breast case. There are a number of cases I see against nurse practitioners and physicians where a patient comes in with chest pain. Often a younger patient, a 40-year-old, let's say, comes in with chest pain, and the practitioner doesn't evaluate the patient for a heart attack, for an MI, a heart attack. They think it's musculoskeletal, so it turns out it is a heart attack, and then the patient will sue for that later on. And then the third sort of red flag complaint would be lower abdominal pain. And there are just so many things that could be that there are things missed. So it could be just constipation. It could be a viral gastroenteritis, neither of which are life-threatening. But it could also be an ectopic pregnancy in a female or an appendicitis. So, and a number of other things. And so it's those number of other things and appendicitis that often go missed.
Mm-hmm.
So those three things, breast, chest, breast lump, or breast complaint, chest pain, and lower abdominal pain, I think are the areas that practitioners should have their antenna go up when they hear that as a chief complaint, to rule out the worst things first.
Well, and they all have some catastrophic outcomes associated with them if the warning signs are missed or misdiagnosed or ignored.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see why those cases would really raise red flags. And I think the chest pain case, I've seen a number of cases that came into my legal nurse consulting business involving chest pain that was misdiagnosed as epigastric pain or completely dismissed, you know, with some horrible outcomes.
Right. Yeah, well, so the trick to being a great practitioner is to know these areas that are red flag areas, and then when the person comes in complaining of that, you just get right on it, knowing that, I mean, the odds are it could be nothing, but this could be catastrophic if it's something.
Mm-hmm.
Before I continue with the program, I wanted to share with you a resource
that is designed to help you with analyzing cardiac risk cases. In this program, Dr. Rosemary McGeady, JD, shares her special perspective as a cardiologist who became a plaintiff medical malpractice attorney. She teaches you the most common causes of cardiac risk cases with medical malpractice. What two groups of patients are at greatest risk for having non-classic signs of a heart attack that could be misdiagnosed? Practical advice about how to communicate with your physician. Who's the go-to person in a physician's office? How to find a doctor for a second opinion. The three elements she uses to evaluate a potential medical malpractice claim. And why she takes only 30 medical malpractice cases per year and rejects 1,400. The one-hour program is called Analyzing Cardiac Risk Cases, an interview I did with Dr. Rosemary McGeady, JD. You may order it for $9.97 at http://lnc.tips/cardiac-risk. That's all one word. http://lnc.tips/cardiac-risk. And get 25% off that price by using the code LISTENED. Let's continue.
I wanted to move on and talk about prescriptive privileges for nurse practitioners and some of the prescribing errors that you have seen. Is it true now that nurse practitioners have prescribing privileges in all 50 states in the United States?
Yes. Yes. The mechanism can be different in different states, and they can have the authority to prescribe different classes of medications, but they have the ability in all 50 states, yes, for the authority.
And I have become aware, as our show has gained more listeners, that we have listeners in 18 to 20 countries around the world. So could you explain for the non-Americans, does a nurse practitioner who has prescribing privileges have to have a physician review that prescription before it's handed to the patient?
Right. In no state that no state does a nurse practitioner have to run the prescription by a physician or run each prescription by a physician. States, each law has its own law regarding the authority of nurse practitioners to diagnose and treat and prescribe. And in some states, nurse practitioners can diagnose, treat, and prescribe without any connection to a physician. I mean, they may choose to consult with a physician, but they don't have to. In other states, there needs to be a written agreement between the physician and the nurse practitioner about what exactly the nurse practitioner can do. And those written agreements often cover diagnosis, making medical diagnosis, ordering medical therapies, and prescribing. And I don't believe there's any state where a physician has to co-sign, and no state where they have to run, no nurse practitioner has to run every prescription by a physician. But in some states, there are requirements such as the physician has to review a certain small percentage of the charts randomly to see what was going on and then supervise. So, but each state is different. But in all states, nurse practitioners can prescribe.
Well, thank you for that clarification. That's really good background information. And one other question along those lines is that it's my understanding that nurse practitioners who are considered advanced practice nurses at this point are being prepared in master's programs, but there was some talk a few years back about wanting the basic preparation to include a doctoral degree as well. Is there any update on that movement?
Well, there was a goal of having the doctorate be the entry level, as I think by 2015, clearly we're past that. It's all still optional. the doctorate is still optional. And any nurse practitioner with a master's degree is not going to be required to get a doctoral degree. There are some programs where the initial advanced degree is a doctorate, but it's not mandatory, and I don't see that happening.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, each state has its own rules, and no state has made it mandatory for a nurse practitioner to have a doctorate.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate that updated information. I know that you talked in the past about doing a script analysis, SCRIPT, when it comes to prescribing errors. Could you take us through those steps and what that means?
Yeah, that's just a little reminder to nurse practitioners when they're prescribing to, for each time they prescribe, that they should, these things should run through their head. S, are there side effects that I need to talk to the patient about? C, are there contraindications for this patient? R, is this the right medication? I, are there any interactions with the patient's other medications that I should be aware of? P, are there any precautions for this patient? And then T is for transmittal, and that is, have I transmitted this prescription in a clear way? In other words, there are cases where the whole malpractice lawsuit is based on somebody not writing clearly, and the pharmacist mistaken the prescription for something else. So ideally, prescribers are familiar with the medicines they write, and hopefully they aren't writing for thousands of types of medicines. They usually have an arsenal of a few medications they use frequently. So the first few times you write for a medication, hopefully you'd sort of, at least in your head, if not going to the PDR or Hippocrates, you'd go through this analysis. Then after a while, you're going to sort of memorize it. So when I was transitioning, when I was still working as a nurse practitioner, but also working as a lawyer, but working less as a nurse practitioner, I wasn't prescribing as often as when I had been full-time. So I made myself, every time I wrote a prescription, go to the PDR and look up these things and go over with the patient. And it takes a little extra time, but it saves you. It saves you and the patient from some bad outcomes.
It reminds me of a day about a year ago when my husband was meeting his gerontologist for the first time at Johns Hopkins, and the doctor was considering putting my husband on a different medication for his diabetes, and he went to the computer and he was reviewing the medication on the screen and saying, you know, talking about the benefits and the side effects. And as we drove away, my husband said, shouldn't he have known that medication? You know, why was he looking it up? And I said, well, he was being very careful and very cautious.
Yeah.
And making sure that he was clear on whether this was the right drug for you.
Yeah, right. Good for him. Good for that doctor, yeah. I don't know if you saw, but there was an article in the Chicago Tribune a couple of days ago which talked about, the Chicago Tribune sent out fake patients who were reporters with prescriptions. I believe something like there were given two prescriptions which had bad interactions with each other, and the object was to see if the pharmacist told the patient anything about it. And the whole article is about the percentages in various pharmacy chains where the pharmacist did not mention it. So in real life, there's two checks and balances. One is the prescriber needs to be checking for interactions, and the second thing is the pharmacist needs to be checking for interactions. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Have you seen in your practice any alarming prescribing errors, or more commonly occurring alarming errors?
Yeah, well, I don't think the basis of that many lawsuits are prescribing errors for nurse practitioners. I know that I'm talking to insurers of nurse practitioners, they are worried about prescribing. And I guess certainly the threat is there. But here's two cases that I find interesting that have to do with prescribing. In the first one, a nurse practitioner was seeing a new patient to the nurse practitioner. The patient had just gotten out of a mental institution and was on several psych meds. And the patient comes to the community clinic, and the nurse practitioner is talking about renewing the psych meds. And the patient talked to the nurse practitioner out of discontinuing at least one of the psych meds. Didn't like the side effects, didn't need it, et cetera, et cetera. The nurse practitioner did not have benefit of the records from the psych hospital, but the nurse practitioner discontinued at least one of the psych meds. And the patient came back, I don't know how much time later, a week or 2 weeks later, and assaulted people in the clinic, having had a breakdown. And then, in this case, not only did the patient sue the nurse practitioner, but the people who were assaulted sued. Horrible case. And the take-home message there is, don't be discontinuing medications based on what the patient wants. If the patient really needs the medication, I mean, this nurse practitioner didn't have access to old records, but clearly before discontinuing psych meds, you'd want to, if you want to prevent problems, you'd want to either talk with the previous provider or get those records. But discontinuing psych meds is not a good idea. Generally. Okay, so that was one thing. And then another case, a patient came to a clinic, saw a family nurse practitioner about blood pressure, a few things, and then was also seeing a psych nurse practitioner at that same clinic. And the psych nurse practitioner put the patient on Lamictal or Lamotrigine. And then a couple weeks go by, and the patient comes back to see the family nurse practitioner. And the patient was having some problems with a rash and a couple of other problems. I can't remember what. But it turns out those problems were related to the psych med that the psych nurse practitioner had prescribed. The family nurse practitioner didn't pick up on the side effects of that medication. The patient ended up getting Stevens-Johnson syndrome and had to be hospitalized in intensive care, all based on the side effects to the psych medicine. The patient survived, but sued the clinic and the family nurse practitioner for not picking up on the side effect. And the family nurse practitioner testified that she didn't believe she was responsible for medicines that were not prescribed by her. And the judge... That did not make the judge happy. The judge says, you most certainly are. A, you should have known about this side effect. B, yes, you are responsible for the picking up on the side effects of medications prescribed by other people. So what we learned from that case is, yes, you are responsible if you're a family practitioner for picking up on the side effects of medication prescribed by some other practitioner. And B, we learned that that psych medicine has certain side effects you have to be aware of if that patient's on that. So those aren't the common prescribing errors, which I'd say when I think of common prescribing errors, I think of somebody choosing the wrong medication or having too big a dose. It's more complicated than that, and
It certainly is. And I remember working on a case with the same medication with Lamictal that was given to a teenage boy, and the question was, he was outside of the range for being the appropriate patient for that drug. He was too young, and he ended up with a rash and lost most of his skin. He survived it, a lot of scarring. He was critically ill for a long time. Huge damages.
Yeah, and do we have time? I'll give you one more short case.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have time?
Sure.
Okay, yep. So that reminds me of yet another prescribing case, which I thought was very instructive. So a teenage girl, 15, comes into a emergency room complaining of abdominal complaints, and I forget what was done exactly, but she was then referred to her primary care provider, who was a nurse practitioner. So in treating and starting off with the abdominal complaints, the nurse practitioner prescribes Paxil for depression for the girl. And long story short, the girl 3 weeks later tried to hang herself, was unsuccessful in killing herself, but did suffer brain damage and required round-the-clock care for 3 years until she eventually died. The family sued the nurse practitioner, and the basis of the suit was, if you look at the warnings under Paxil, it says, don't prescribe this for adolescents unless there is a major depression. No documentation in the record that there was any screen applied, a depression screen. There was no evidence that the nurse practitioner had suspected major depression. So if the nurse practitioner had suspected major depression, she should have referred to a psychiatrist or inpatient care or so on. But at any rate, it was kind of a slam dunk case against the nurse practitioner when you've got a warning that says don't prescribe except for major depression, and there was no documentation of major depression. So same kind of age-related precautions that perhaps, I guess if that nurse practitioner had done this script analysis like we talked about earlier, she would have come up with a reason not to prescribe that medication, or prescribe it but immediately hook the patient up with a specialist.
And such a tragic outcome, too.
Yeah.
How can our listeners find out more about you, Carolyn?
Well, my website is the best way, and it's www.bupert.com, B-U-P-P-E-R-T.com. And through that, there's a way to contact me if someone has a question.
I so appreciate the time that you spent with us today. It's been really instructive talking to you, and I know that we could have talked about cases and stories for a long time and not exhausted the amount of knowledge that is stored in your head about these issues. So I really appreciate you sharing your expertise with our group.
Well, it's my pleasure, Pat. It seems like we kind of built on each other. Both of us have some experience in this area. So it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. And this has been Legal Nurse Podcast. We have been talking with Carolyn Bupert about nurse practitioner liability issues, as well as some other common medical malpractice concerns and red flags. Stay tuned for our program next week. We'll be back with an interview in a week from today. And we appreciate the comments and the attention and the listeners that have been part of this show.
Thanks for being a part of this program. Check out our online training and books at LegalNurseBusiness.com. Expand your LNC skills with our resources. Also, explore coaching with me at LNCAcademy.com to get more clients, make more money, and avoid expensive mistakes. And finally, join our continuing education program and get monthly trainings at LNCCEU.com. You'll get 2 online trainings each month designed to deepen your knowledge and skills. And look forward to having you tune into our programs again next week. Use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount on this product. You'll put that code LISTENED in the coupon code box during checkout.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on LegalNurseBusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes. We always are interested in your ideas for new topics. Please leave a comment on legalnursepodcasts.com. Join our community and get notified of each new episode and receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on legalnursepodcasts.com. We appreciate you and your interest.